Oldie Lunch Recordings presents Stephen Clark on how the French won Waterloo, or think they did. Sponsored by Doro, number one in the senior mobile market.
Actually, I have a French parrot joke, which just came. I was talking to Barry earlier on about the differences between the French sense of humour and the British sense of humour, which isn't exactly that we've got one and they haven't, but sometimes it seems a bit like that. But someone said to me, I don't understand, a French person said to me, I don't understand British humour, especially those Monty Python. I mean, don't the English people know that there are no parrots in Norway? anyway, yeah, so I live in Paris. I live in France. I've lived there for 20 years, and I do find that living there as a Brit, especially if, like me, you write history books, you get blamed for a lot of things you didn't do, like, for example, burning Joan of Arc. I didn't do it. Actually, in my book, A Thousand Years of Annoying Adventure, I tried to prove that it wasn't our fault, actually, but that's another story. But, you know, they blame me for burning Joan of Arc, even though they do say, the French do say that Joan of Arc is the only thing that we Brits have ever cooked properly. And even then, we overdid her, you know. I get blamed for her. I get blamed for Dunkirk, you know, running away from France, even though I do try and point out that we did actually take about 150,000 French soldiers with us. The thing is, they immediately came back and surrendered, but that wasn't our fault, you know. That's true. Sometimes I get blamed for messing up Normandy. You know, we invaded in 1944, and we left all these tank tracks everywhere, we messed up the beaches, you know, bombed a few towns, ports, you know, we get blamed for everything. But the only thing I never get blamed for, which I thought was rather strange, was Waterloo. And I started to wonder about this, and I realised, reading up about it, that the reason we don't get blamed for it is because they actually think they won. Which is why I wrote a book called How the French Won Waterloo, or Think They Did. Because, I mean, to my surprise, there is a whole school of French historical thought that denies the fact that, or we see it as a fact, that Britain and Prussia won Waterloo. And the wonderful thing for me is that, I mean, I've only got 10 minutes now, but I could talk to you for hours about all the different ways they try and wriggle out of this defeat. And I mean, I quote in the book lots of French historians, ranging from the most recent one, the former French Prime Minister Dominique de Villepin, wrote a book about Napoleon in which he said that Waterloo is a defeat that shines with the aura of victory. Okay, and he's one of the moderates, you know. I found another French poet who prefaced one of his poems in the 19th century with a quote about defeats are merely victories to which fortune has not given wings. So there are all these wonderful French ways of being a winner while losing. But that's if you accept that they actually won. Now, before Waterloo, French historians say that we Brits, we cheated, okay? We cheated. We were paying all these foreign powers to gang up on Napoleon. Now, this is totally true. We were paying everyone. In fact, Britain got into so much debt that the debt wasn't paid off until 1906. Okay, so for once, the French are actually right. And I even found the record of one payment to the Prussians in 1813 of £666,666. Now, you know, how diabolically anti-French can you get? And that was true as well. So we were actually doing nasty things. But then you could say, you know, it's rather clever, really. Instead of sending your own soldiers to get massacred, pay someone else to do it. That's what we were doing. So we were ganging up on Napoleon, who, of course, was a total peacemonger. And there are I've quoted some beautiful letters he used to write to the Brits now and again, saying, you know, I'm a peace lover, I want peace with Britain. But he said things like, but if you don't want peace, war has never diminished my glory. Every peace, you know, offer he made was really, you know, if you don't want peace, I'll come and punch you. But it, you know, we kept provoking him. Even his, you know, his invasion of Russia in 1812, where he took about, well, people aren't sure, but he took around about 750,000 soldiers. He came back with less than 10%. Now, bad planning. You know, what he said was, even that he didn't lose. He said it got colder much earlier than in a normal year. Wasn't my fault. the weather got it wrong. You know, he came back with less than 10% people, and he blamed us for that, because he said the only reason he invaded Russia was because he'd imposed this perfectly logical system on the whole of Europe called le blocus continental, whereby no one in Europe was allowed to buy British goods. Now, the Tsar of Russia and the Russians were quite keen on tea, which we were importing favourable prices, and cheap cutlery. We were making, in the early 19th century, we were making lots of cheap knives and forks. The Russians started to buy these things. Napoleon was so angry that he invaded Russia and basically wiped out a large chunk of the French male population. It was our fault. But he kept putting armies together again. Okay. Now, he was eventually, after Russia, things went downhill for him. France was invaded. He was sent off to Elba in a beautiful French island in exile. And but he came back in 1815. Again, that was our fault. He wanted peace. He was king of Elba, which, if you've ever been there, is a wonderful place to be king. But, you know, beautiful island, lots of Italian food. He had some lovely houses. But he came back because we Brits had put on the throne Louis XVIII, whom the French despised, because Louis XVIII was sort of a caricature of a French king, and he actually literally was so, you know, the Belgians used to call him Louis de Tzwit, which was a joke. It meant Louis II, but it also meant Louis the Sweaty, because he was known for sitting down at banquets and eating so much that he just sort of almost exploded. And he did literally, actually, at the end of his life, rot to death from overindulgence. And we put this man on the throne. So, and Louis also didn't pay the French army. So when Napoleon came back, the French army immediately turned round and supported him, obviously. And so Napoleon came back. Again, he sued for peace. We didn't want it, our fault yet again, which is when we started cheating again, which when this happened, Wellington, very, supposed to be the model of fair play, but of course Wellington, being English, started cheating. He went to Belgium, and he scouted out a good place to face up to Napoleon if Napoleon broke out of France, which they thought he would do, because he'd done it before, obviously. And he found this wonderful crossroads near just south of Brussels with some high ground, which would be easy to defend. And he chose that as the future battlefield, you know. But that's cheating. How can you do that sort of thing? You know, we would say reconnaissance to the French is cheating. For these French historians, they get furious about this stuff. So Wellington was cheating. By this time, French historians are getting a bit desperate. So they do actually revert to toilet humour slightly. And they say, look, it wasn't fair, because Napoleon, by this time, he was suffering from terrible piles, hemorrhoids. Now, you might think that Spike Milligan was obsessed with hemorrhoids. You've never read a French historian. The descriptions of his sufferings in French history books, which I quote, are quite wonderful. The best of them is a fairly modern writer called Max Gellow, who writes one of the most, let's say, bloody descriptions of hemorrhoids I've ever read in my life, all of which is saying, look, Napoleon wasn't feeling too good on the day. Even Napoleon's brother, after the event, Jerome, wrote a story about, told all about Napoleon having warm anal baths before the battle. He was suffering. He wasn't at his best on the day of the battle. Some historian, French historians, even go so far as saying that he might have been suffering from syphilis, which probably wasn't true, but, you know, they will give any excuse for underperformance. They also say that he had, you know, his generals. He was betrayed by his generals, which was true. But his generals weren't very good at Waterloo. They messed up. But this was because all his good generals had been killed during his disastrous campaigns throughout Europe. His aide-de-camp, a fellow called Berthier, had actually leapt out of the window of his chateau to kill himself so he wouldn't be involved in Waterloo, because he thought, you know, it was just going to be a catastrophe. So, yes, Napoleon was not served very well by his generals. But the clinching argument of them all is that, the big one, the reason why Napoleon might not have done all that well at Waterloo, if, as a French person, you can accept that he didn't, the reason why he didn't do all that well was because God decided to be on the side of the British. Now, you see, what God did on the day before, was on June the 17th, 1815, he made it rain. Now, He made it rain. God made it rain. Well, God's omniscient, so he knew very well that the key to any Napoleonic battle was maneuvering the cannons into place and then bombarding the enemy. So by making it very muddy, God knew that Napoleon wouldn't be able to maneuver his cannons, and that when he fired the cannonballs, instead of bouncing, there are these terrible stories in some of the veterans' accounts I found that the great damage of cannonballs wasn't just done by a cannonball flying through the air and smashing into people. They used to smash into people and then bounce and then smash into more people and then bounce and smash. They used to go way behind the lines, killing people. But of course, on June the 18th, they just plopped into the mud. Lots of them. So again, the British had help, you know. And the person who explains this very seriously is someone you might know if you've been to a musical in the West End. The man who wrote Les Misérables, before he started writing West End musicals, he wrote it in novel form, Les Misérables, which is actually a wonderful novel containing some of the best anti-war writing about Waterloo I've ever read. Hugo explained that God decided to make Napoleon lose. He actually admits that Napoleon might have lost, because Napoleon was such a great figure that the 19th century couldn't get started if he was still in office. And this is serious. This is perfectly serious. Now, what Hugo says that is that Napoleon didn't lose. Napoleon lost, but France won. Hugo says that France won because right at the end of the battle, the British had surrounded the last remaining square of the Imperial Guard, and they offered them the chance to surrender. Now, the general in charge of them, a fellow called Cambronne, a very famous man in France, replied by saying, merde. I don't know if you know what that means. Anyway, I've written five novels with that word in the title. It's the French word for poo. He said to them, poo. They were a bit annoyed, and so they just obliterated the whole lot of them. Not very sporting, but anyway, what Hugo says that this standing up to the British artillery and saying merde, that was the moral victory on the day. So France won, even if Napoleon didn't. Now, Napoleon himself wouldn't have agreed, and when Napoleon was sent into exile in 1815, incidentally saved by Wellington, the French and the Prussians wanted to shoot him, cut his head off, they wanted to get rid of Napoleon. Wellington refused to have any part in this, and so he got him exiled, and Napoleon sat down and showed his gratitude by basically rewriting history. He rewrote his own story. Very clever thing to do. And what he explained, in fact, he started it before that, what he explained was that, on the day, he may have lost part of the battle, but what actually happened was he beat the British and only lost to the Prussians. And I can quote from his official report on the battle. He says, by mid-afternoon, the battle was won. This is Waterloo. We were occupying all the positions that the enemy had occupied at the start of the battle. He won the Battle of Waterloo. Okay? Then the Prussians came along and sort of slightly changed the result. But that was another battle. Okay? So he actually, it was the score draw, basically. And if you go back, what amazes me is that if you go back to Waterloo now, which I did because I was invited by the Belgian TV to comment on the reenactment, which was quite fun because most of the commentary after the first 5 minutes was, oh, isn't there a lot of smoke? But if you go back now to Waterloo, you would actually think that Napoleon won. I counted the statues in the souvenir shops, 6 different statuettes of Napoleon, 0 of Wellington. You go into this beautiful building called the Panorama, which is a 100-year-old portrait commissioned by the Belgians 100 years ago to commemorate the battle. You see, it's a wonderful piece of early 20th century oil painting depicting the battle. Now, in that area of Belgium, it's a French-speaking area, and the painter was French. So it's not a surprise when you see this battle, which is basically, it's a wonderful, wonderfully depicted cavalier charge, with you can practically hear the horses and the French soldiers snorting as they charge across the battlefield. You can see Napoleon in one corner on his white charger with his long greatcoat and his black hat. And then up in one corner, you can see this hook-nosed general who apparently is about to be skewered by a French cavalryman. This is the Battle of Waterloo. when you go there. They've just replaced it by a big visitor centre, but that just carries on the same myth, really. Napoleon is the star of the battle. And he won. If you are, the latter part of my book actually is about how, in fact, you have to admit that even if Napoleon lost the battle, he's won the war, because he is now the world famous leader from that period. And when I say world famous, I'm not joking. I was touring the Czech Republic because the Czechs put on a stage production of one of my novels, and they invited me to go along. And we pulled over into a car park in the south of the Czech Republic, and I noticed that the car park was guarded by a Napoleonic soldier. And I said, is this usual in Czech Republic? And they said, oh no, it's because we're near the site of the Battle of Austerlitz. But wait, it gets even better. And we drove out of this service station towards the battlefield, and there was a huge cement works, okay? The cement works was two towers with a sort of conveyor belt which takes the rubble, whatever cement's made out of, up into the factory. And it had been converted so that the two towers were painted like Napoleonic artillerymen, and the conveyor belt had been made into a cannon. So in the middle of the Czech countryside now, there is a Napoleonic artillery team greeting everyone who drives past on the motorway. He is a star. Every town we went to was, Napoleon slept here, Napoleon likes our sausages, everywhere. I was recently in Fontainebleau near Paris for the auction of one of Napoleon's hats. 1.8 million euros for a hat, bought by South Korean businessman, a chicken producer, who wants to put it in the lobby of his head office so that he can show that he, like Napoleon, is a winner. This is serious. So, Napoleon has won the propaganda battle. So Napoleon has won. So I'm losing to British time now, you see. Napoleon has won the war, I should say. Very quickly, if you go to France now, French laws are all Napoleonic. He invented the lycée, the baccalaureate, the French university system. He even apparently invented the code which governs taxis to this day, which may be why French Parisian taxi drivers are such little Napoleons. But most of all, what I think his legacy is, you just have to remember that Napoleon's great dream was a federal Europe in which everyone would be using French technology and subsidizing French farmers. Which may sound familiar. So maybe he did win. Thank you.
The Oldie Magazine Recordings. This is a Radio Gorgeous production for The Oldie 2015.